WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of the gains made by the women's movement, many adolescent girls get stuck in a self-esteem crisis. A 1990 study by the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, found that girls' self-esteem plummets when they reach adolescence. After my guest Peggy Orenstein read that study, she decided to do some research of her own. She spent the 1992-93 school year following eighth-grade girls in two California schools, Weston, a suburban middle school with a reputation for excellence, and Audubon Middle School, which Orenstein describes as serving a beleaguered urban community that is nearly 90% ethnic minority, mostly poor or working poor. In association with the AAUW, she's published her findings in her new book, Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. Orenstein is former managing editor of Mother Jones magazine. She told me about the AAUW study of adolescent girls that inspired her to investigate further.
The AUW did a survey called Shortchanging Girls, Shortchanging America that showed that girls' self-esteem plummets further than boys' adolescence and never really catches back up. And when I read about that report in my morning paper, it just kind of catapulted me back to that time, I guess. I really remembered what it felt like to be a young girl and to receive those mixed messages that I think a lot of us received about second-class status in the classroom, about the importance of intelligence versus the importance of appearance, about struggles with body image, about struggles with developing a healthy sexuality. And I got to thinking about it, and I just really wanted to go back and see what it was like for girls today.
Let's start with Weston first, the suburban school.
Sure.
And you found here that most girls were overtly encouraged to fulfill their potential, and yet they learned different lessons anyways.
When you're talking about the classroom, what happens is that boys learn to get ahead and girls learn to get along. So that when I would go into, say, a math classroom at Weston, there would always be some boys in the class who would be shooting their hand up when they had an answer and yelling, me, 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 and sometimes even snapping their fingers. Whereas what would happen with the girls is that they would raise their hands politely and play by the rules. And the boys got rewarded for that behavior, and they knew it. So that after class one day, I was standing and talking to a boy named Nate, who was saying to me, you know, the girls, they raise their hand when they have a question, and they will leave their hand up until the bell rings and the teacher won't call on them. Well, forget about that. When I have something to say, I yell it out, because even if I get in trouble, and even if the teacher yells at me, I still always get my answer.
One of the teachers even said to you, I definitely play to the boys, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and, you know, the boys are louder.
Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, I actually had the same problem. I have to admit, when I was doing the research for Schoolgirls, I'd sit in the classrooms, and boys would pull my attention away from what I was doing all the time. And I think because, you know, I'm a nice girl, too, I had a hard time saying to them, you know, knock it off, bub. I'm trying to watch the girls over here. I would kind of say, yeah, well, what is it that you want? And then turn back to the girls. And then, you know, I kept getting my attention pulled away. So it's not so easy.
You say the worst things that you could call a girl at Weston is either a schoolgirl or a slut. Mm-hmm. What's the meaning of those two expressions?
A schoolgirl is like a perfect girl. It's the girl who does her homework, is very prim, is prissy, proper, probably doesn't talk a lot in class. It's a good girl. It's the, you know, the age-old good girl. Girl doesn't want to be a good girl, and yet the not the only alternative, but the other end of the spectrum, which is worse, is that a girl doesn't want to be a slut. What I found was that the girls were encouraged to be desirable, to be attractive to boys, and that was something that was very important to them, and yet they were discouraged from feeling any desire themselves. So it made this weird split in them that was where they viewed their own desire as something bad and dangerous, and they feared being called a slut.
How did they explain to you that they feared having any desires themselves?
Well, there's actually a chapter in the book called Sluts, where we talk about that. And I really go through the story of one girl in that chapter, Evie. And Evie considered having sex with a boy, and her, you know, her story is just sort of a typical story of Western girls' attitude towards sex, towards towards their desire of seeing intercourse as the fulcrum of sex, of thinking about intercourse, you know, way too young. These girls are thinking about it at 12 and 13 in a really serious way, which is something I think parents, you know, need to get a handle on. And this boy asked her to have sex, and she had a dream. She started having dreams, nightmares, of a girl that she knew who had had sex with a boy, and then he dumped her, and then he'd say he loved her, and she'd go back and have sex with him again, and then he would dump her, and she's now in a school for troubled girls or some kind of continuation school, whereas the boy is still at Weston and still popular, and she was afraid that if she ended up having sex with this boy, that would happen to her. And so with Evie, for her, considering sex made her feel bad about herself, made her feel like she was a slut, made her feel like she had to suppress her desire. You know, what she said, some of these girls were so almost literary sometimes in the way that they talked. She said that she wished that her soul were a piece of glass so she could get some Windex and wipe it clean. And that was how she was feeling about herself.
Even though she hadn't had sex.
Even though she hadn't had it. And the girls, you know, as we go through that chapter, you see that kind of coming up again and again, this split between being desired and desiring.
The self-esteem of girls is very tied in to how they look, more so than boys. At least that's one of the findings of the American Association of University Women's
Study. And lots
study,
of other people.
And lots of other people, too.
Yeah.
How much trouble did the girls you studied, how much trouble did they have with eating disorders?
That's a big issue. I mean, it's not just even eating disorders. You know, some girls, of course, develop eating disorders, but it's just negative body image in general and believing that, you know, that they're too fat when they're normal, that they're too fat when they're thin, that unless they have an eating disorder, that they're too fat. So, you know, I was on the schoolyard one day with the girls, and one of the girls pointed at a potato chip wrapper at another girl's foot and said, "Becca, you know, you littered." And Becca said, "I didn't litter. I don't eat." And the other girl said, "You don't eat? I don't eat either." And they gave each other the thumbs up sign. You know, and I was standing there and I was just appalled. You know, I think that parents don't know. The girls talk about body and about, you know, and there's part of them, they'll say, "I know that it's not the most important thing to be thin. I know that I don't have to look like a model." And yet, they also don't know that. And in a really deep internalized way, they don't think they have the right to eat. And this was really endemic with the girls in the middle class school. I was really surprised, I guess, not so much that they had body image issues, but how young. I mean, these girls are 13, and it was really already entrenched. So you wonder, you know, must have gotten there early. I know that there's some studies that say that girls as young as 7 have internalized this idea of thinness as success, thinness as beauty.
Let's shift our attention to the inner city school that you looked at and compare what was happening with the girls there. One of the things that you noticed was that in this school, girls were more likely than boys to attend school on a regular basis. Were they more ready, though, to speak up in class and, you know, to be active participants in class, too?
Yeah, especially a lot of the African-American girls really were quite vocal in class, but that was not necessarily encouraged or used in a positive way. You know, generally what happens with African-American girls in class is that very vocal girls are used kind of as rule enforcers, as kind of junior teachers, as junior disciplinarians, so that a lot of times you'll see a teacher say, "Okay, everybody be quiet now," and this girl will put her hands on her hips and say, "Okay, everybody be quiet now," and she's not necessarily getting reinforced for academic participation, but for some sort of stereotypical behavior.
What behavior?
For being a kind of assertive, disciplinarian black woman.
You say that the word respect came up almost obsessively among the girls that you spoke with. What were the things that they thought conferred respect on them and the things that didn't really matter in terms of getting respect?
Well, I think in general at Audubon, what mattered was survival. And survival was more important than school. So that the things that conferred respect were the things that helped one survive, whether that was being good with your fists or something like that. And doing well in school was not something that conferred respect necessarily because it did not help you survive in an area that was, you know, a really tough environment. And what I saw with the girls, that a lot of what conferred power and competence and self-worth, you know, like I said, girls tend to take on their mother's problems. And what would happen in the urban environment was that the girls would actually take on their mother's roles, so that a girl like LaRonda in the book or April in the book or other girls whose mothers are unable to take care of their children because they're working mothers, single working mothers with no child care, or because they're single mothers with many children and just don't have the time and energy to take care of all of them, or because in one of the girls' cases, her mom was incapacitated by chemical dependency on crack, the girl stands up and she becomes the mom, and she's got to take care of the younger kids, and she does that at the expense of her own education and her own future. And it's a really important thing to know, because there was one study that I read that said that that is the reason why 25% of girls drop out because of that, not because they're having their own children, but because they have to mother their siblings. And so a girl like LaRonda, who was very bright and felt this strong sense of competence that was not being recognized at the school, you know, I'd meet her third period. She was just getting to school. She was dabbing on her lipstick. She was messing with her braids. And, you know, she said, I don't care if I miss school. My brothers and sisters need me. I have to get them up. I have to get them dressed. I have to make the breakfast. I got to get them to school. But the competence that she's showing is not recognized in school. It just becomes a battle. So that when I was talking to one of her counselors, you know, he was saying, you know, I don't care why she's late. She's late. He didn't know why she was late.
Journalist Peggy Orenstein is my guest. Her new book is called Schoolgirls, Young Women's Self-Esteem and the Confidence Gap. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about adolescent girls and their crisis in confidence. My guest is journalist Peggy Orenstein. Now, for the girls at the suburban school, self-image was so important, mm-hmm. physical self-image. And there were a lot of eating disorders and mm-hmm. a lot of insecurities. Am I too fat? Mm-hmm. You know, am I pretty enough? Was there anything comparable among the African-American girls at the inner city school?
Well, I think that the body image problems were not the same. You know, I think in African-American culture, bigness is allowed for women. You know, it's okay to be big. I mean, sometimes bigness is fetishized in rap music and all of that kind of thing. But there's also a way that black women are allowed power, they're allowed size. And one of the girls, one of the real bright rays of hope in the book is Dashelle, who is a really big girl. And she made the honor roll every quarter. And at one point I said to her, you know, are you ever concerned about being big? Do you think boys won't like you or something? And she said, it don't matter to me that I'm healthy. Why would that bother me? It's my brain, not my body, that's going to get somewhere. She was the only girl I heard say that.
What about the other girls? How much was a body image a really important self-defining issue?
It just wasn't. You know, I think that having powerful bodies, particularly in an urban area, was kind of helpful. You know, it helped. It was strength and power, and you needed that physical power to survive.
One of the girls told you that she thought if she wanted to achieve what she did, and if she wanted to succeed, that the most important thing she needed to do was to basically stay away from boys, to not mm-hmm. have a boyfriend.
Yeah, that was Dashelle, and I heard that from a number of girls, that they felt that the only thing that was going to keep them safe was to lock out their social life, and it was such an improbable thing, you know, that they were going to make it through high school deprived of friends and deprived of companionship from boys. You know, that's part of adolescence. But the teachers agreed with that. I talked to one of the teachers about it who said, you know, she's talked to high school teachers and she sees that the kids who want to get ahead have to be like they're wearing blinders. It was interesting, though. You know, I asked LaRonda about her role models while I was reporting Schoolgirls, and she said that there was one boy in her neighborhood who sold crack, but he went to high school, too, and got good grades. And she said, you know, the other boys called him schoolboy. There could also be schoolboys, although it wasn't as bad as being a schoolgirl. The other boys called him schoolboy, and they made fun of him. And they said, you know, you can't do both, you can't do both. And he said he was going to do both. And she said, you know, he's a role model. He's a role model for us all.
You said that you thought the Latina girls had more of a self-esteem problem than the African-American girls.
Yeah.
And that was also a conclusion that the American Association of University Women reached in its study.
Yeah.
What were the signs of this lower self-esteem?
The girls are, a lot of the Latina girls are very quiet. A lot of them sort of slip through until they slip out. It's hard, you know, there's not a lot of attention paid to their culture. There's a lot of stereotyping of Latina girls as being from a certain kind of culture that treats its girls and women a certain way, and so there's nothing you can do about that. Latina girls, you know, particularly in the West and Southwest, I don't know so much about the rest of the country, are very vulnerable to gangs right now. And Marta, who's the Latina girl who I focus on most particularly in the book, is going through the process of, you know, when she was a younger girl, she was thinking about being a lawyer. She was really excited about school. And she had been slipping. You know, I talked to teachers about her, and sometimes they weren't even sure who she was. And by the end of the year I spent with her, at the beginning of the year, she said, you know, she'd point out girls in gangs to me and say, you know, those girls, they think it's all about being in a gang. And you know how they get into the gang is that sometimes it's the same way boys do, that they just beat the girls up. But sometimes they have to sleep with every boy in the gang or a select number of boys or men, adult men, in the gang in order to gain entree. And by the end of the year, she seemed pretty much ready to do that. She was choosing between gangs like she was choosing between sororities.
What was your reaction to her? Were you able to maintain your distance as just observer when you found that out?
No, actually, that was the other time when I broke through. There was a woman who was coming into Audubon. This was a really great thing. She was from the YWCA, and she was a young Latina woman from these girls' neighborhood. She was about 21 years old, and she was leading a support group for the 8th grade girls, which, you know, started out being fairly small, but over the course of the week got bigger and bigger and bigger until she almost couldn't do anything with the girls. There were so many of them. And I did tell her that Marta was thinking, and it was clear she would go around every session and have a check-in where the kids would talk about whatever was going on with them that week. And it became clear that Marta was on the peripheries of a gang, and I told her that I knew that she was seriously considering jumping in. And unfortunately, it was the very end of the school year, and I don't know that she could do anything about it at that point, but at least she was alerted.
What issues in your life did this work bring back up again?
Man, this catapulted me right back to adolescence, and I have to say, you know, this was a hard book. Schoolgirls was a hard book to report because it kept me right there the whole time. It kept me just nose to nose with everything that happened to me in adolescence. And, you know, I dragged my friends right back there with me, so it kept them nose to nose, too. And it actually seems to have that effect on readers. And in the end, it was a really healthy thing for me. It was very painful. It brought me up against not only some of the ways that I remember pulling back in school, but other ways I remembered pulling back. I talk just a little bit in the book about having an eating disorder when I was in high school. And, you know, back then, I had never heard the word anorexia. I didn't know what eating disorders were. And I was very lucky because a good friend of our family was a doctor who was doing early research in eating disorders. He was an endocrinologist. And he pulled me aside and talked to me about it and really helped me through that period. Otherwise, I think, like some girls, I probably would have ended up in the hospital.
You say in the book that you lost 40 pounds and then you basically stopped eating.
Well, I stopped eating in order to lose them.
Oh, okay. Well, I think what you say is you couldn't eat after that.
Yeah, you become, I mean, it's something that I remember. It's just like being down a dark tunnel. You know, nothing else mattered. I remember my school notebooks, you know, how you doodle on your school notebook. Mine was just covered with numbers, you know, and I was trying to figure out calories so that I could keep, I think 500 was the number I decided was like the magic minimum that I could eat and survive and not pass out during the day. But my mind was on nothing else most of the time. You know, it was not on my schoolwork, although I still continued to do well. But, you know, it was just on this constant obsession of what I looked like, and I just had no idea. And I think that's something that, you know, I know so many women who have gone through that and who've had negative body images, and I don't really think it goes away.
Well, one thing that's really mystified me, I figured, you know, since I came of age at the beginning of the resurgence of the women's movement, and I figured, well, boy, by the time, you know, the next generation comes of age, feminism is going to be so ingrained in them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of equality is going to be so ingrained in them. They'll be living completely different lives than I have and be free from those insecurities that defined part of my life. And I mean, what happened? It seems to be almost the other way around, that girls today, in spite of mm-hmm. feminism, are growing up with even more eating disorders and insecurities mm-hmm. and problems in school and, you know, obsessions with boys and, mm-hmm. and so on. Do you have anything you've been thinking about that helps explain that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's important to recognize the progress that has been made,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that is, I think, great. You know, I think that girls do have a lot more role models, that people don't say, you know, girls can't anymore, that girls are not hearing like I did, that it's the, you know, the woman author of the math book was responsible for the mistakes in the math book. And yet it is true that girls are still struggling with this stuff. And I think, you know, so are adult women, you know, and I think that girls see what adult women are going through, and I think that they absorb it. I also think, you know, I've got to think that the last 12 years of setbacks are partially responsible for what's going on with girls. I think that that has hurt, and you know, in the political realm and during the Reagan-Bush years. I think those were very repressive years for women, and I think that those were repressive years for girls, and we're seeing some of the trickle-down. The trickle-down effect is that, you know, it goes from adult women who are in the workplace and who are having all these kinds of conflicts to their daughters.
I guess one of the things that really interested me in your book is that you didn't really find that on the whole teachers or parents were overtly sexist.
No, no. And I'm really glad you brought that up because I just, you know, I hate, and I just don't want to demonize teachers. I think the teachers have such a hard job and they're trying really hard. And they're, you know, most of them, there were a few clinkers in there, but most of them are really caring, good people who want to do right by their students.
And yet there's all this sexist stuff happening in the schools and at home. But it's not because of a total lack of consciousness. It's not because of overt sexism.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of the thing is I think that I've really come to feel strongly that this message has to go to boys as well as girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really big part of the problem is that we need to change the way we raise our sons and the way they treat the girls. Because there was actually a recent New York Times poll that showed, they surveyed, it was a New York Times CBS poll, and they surveyed the ways boys and girls see one another. And boys see themselves as superior to girls, and girls see themselves as equal to boys. This is a very bad recipe.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it was really fun. Thanks, Terry.
Peggy Orenstein is the author of the new book, Schoolgirls. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.